It is May the 23rd, and we are in our creation class. We are beginning Parshas Vayechi on page 268.
It's almost time for Siyum.
It's almost time, but this is going to take us a while. This is not a quick Parsha.
How many years did it take?
It's not quite 4 years yet.
Really?
Yeah. Hello, hello. We'll make it a massive event.
Hi, Sarah was October 07, so...
So we're on page 268. Vayechi Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim 17 shana. Yaakov lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years. Vayechi yemei Yaakov shnei chayav, and it was the years of Yaakov, or the days of Yaakov, the years of his life. Sheva shanim, 7 years. Va'arbo'im u'ma'as shana, and 140 years, 147 years. He lived to be 147 years old. And before we go further, let's analyze this one verse, even though it doesn't seem to say much. It says that Yaakov lived in Egypt for 17 years, and the total years of his life was 147. Now, this information is a little too much, meaning that we could have figured this out. We already know that Yaakov came before Paro when he was 130 years old. That's what it said. Remember, what was the first question out of Paro's mouth? How old are you? And he says, I'm 130 years old and I've had a really rough life. Remember that? Mm-hmm. So then the Torah here tells us Yaakov lived in Egypt for 17 years. Well, we know 130 plus 17 is 147. So there's no need for the Torah to tell us that he lived to be 147, because we already know 130 plus 17 is 147. Or the Torah could have just told us that he lived to be 147, and we would have known that. How long was he in Egypt? For 17 years. Because 147 minus 130 is 17. So the Torah here is telling us what seems to be superfluous information. And we know, of course, the Torah doesn't do that. Now, the number 17 years is very significant. We've had 17 years before as a unit. And it ties in directly to this.
Yosef was sent away. He was sent to his brothers.
Excellent. Perfect. Hold the place here on page 268. Turn back, please, to the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev, which is on page 198. This is when the saga of Yosef and his brothers begins. Here on 198 it says, Vayeshev Yaakov Beretz Migurei Aviv Beretz Canaan. Yaakov dwelled in the land of the sojourning of his father, the land of Canaan. Ela Toldos Yaakov, these are the generations of Yaakov. Yosef ben Shiva Esrei Shanat. Yosef was 17 years old. Hayaro Esachav Batzon, he was shepherding his brothers with the sheep, etc. And of course we know that here is where he's going to have the problem with his brothers, and they're going to sell him into slavery. So Yosef is 17 when he leaves Yaakov, and then Yaakov comes down to Egypt 22 years later, and then is alive for 17 years with Yosef. So Yaakov and Yosef's interaction with each other are two sets of 17 years. Yosef's first 17 years of his life, and then the last 17 years of Yaakov's life, with the 22 years in the middle where they were separated from each other. So what is the significance of this number 17 with them? It would have been nice if it was 18, right? We would have said chai. But that's not what it is. It's 17. So what is the issue here with the 17 years? So there are a couple of approaches. One approach, and this is what I would call the main approach, and I saw it in several places, is that Yaakov took care of Yosef for the first 17 years of his life. Of course, a child and a teenager is supported by his parents. So Yaakov took care of and supported Yosef for 17 years. Then Yosef was sold into slavery, and of course, Yaakov no longer supported him for the next 22 years. By the time they reunite, who's supporting whom? Now Yosef is supporting Yaakov for 17 years. So there is an exact reciprocal relationship here. Well, Yaakov cared for Yosef for 17 years. Now Yosef cares for Yaakov for 17 years. And we know that as people age, we know that there's often a role reversal where parents take care of children when the children are young, and then there's a middle amount of years where the children are already on their own two feet and don't need the parents' constant support, and the parents also, of course, don't need the child's support. But then at the end of their lives, often it's a role reversal where the children end up caring for the parents. Now here it wasn't that Yaakov was too old to care for himself, but Yosef was in the position to care for Yaakov and the entire family. So here we have the exact 17-year mirror image of what happens. That's one approach to the 17 years. It occurred to me as well that Yosef is going to live a total of 110 years. We'll see at the end of Parashas Vayechi, it will tell us that Yosef lives to be 110 years old. Now, of those 110 years, he is in Egypt. He is in Egypt as king for 80 years. He becomes king at age 30. He becomes viceroy at age 30. So for 80 years, he's the viceroy. But that's only how long it is that he's the viceroy. But he's in Egypt since age 17, approximately. You have to take into account the travel time. But at 17, he comes down to Egypt. So there are 13 years before he becomes viceroy, where he's in Egypt, according to most commentaries. Some say there was some interim period there, but according to most commentaries, for those 13 years prior to the time he became viceroy, he was also in Egypt. So Yosef was in Egypt for 93 of his 110 years. Yosef was in Egypt for almost his entire life, with the exception of 17 years. Yaakov is not in Egypt his entire life, except for the last 17 years. We know that Yaakov and Yosef share very similar lives. We've talked about this before, how Yaakov and Yosef looked very similar to each other, how Yaakov was hated by his brother, Yosef was hated by his brothers, how we talked about how there was a decree that Yaakov was really supposed to be dragged down to Egypt in chains. But because Yaakov was supposed to be dragged down to Egypt in chains, but because Yosef was taken down to Egypt in chains, that made up for Yaakov having to do it. That it didn't, Yaakov didn't have to happen to Yaakov because Yosef took his place. Yosef replaced Yaakov in that decree of being taken down to Egypt, and so we find that they mimic each other. It seems to me that Yosef, as we know, Yosef is supposed to be in Egypt. Yosef and the Egyptians are two sides of the same coin. We talked about how the symbol of Yosef is the shor, the ox, and the symbol for the Egyptians are the cow or the calf, the golden calf, etc. And that they're really two sides of the same coin. I wonder if Yosef's lifespan of 110 years was meant to be spent in Egypt. But of course, the first 17 years he wasn't in Egypt. So it was only 93 years that he was in Egypt. Perhaps Yaakov's stay in Egypt for 17 years makes up those 17 years that Yosef was not in Egypt. That for those 17 years, Yaakov is there as well, which makes up for those 17. Perhaps there's something with that as well. At any rate, the correlation you can see. Exactly why there's a correlation that we can talk about further, but there you see that there is a correlation between the two.
Also, Rabbi, Yaakov was very happy to be with Yosef for the first 17 years of his life. Doesn't he say that those were the happiest days of his life, Yaakov?
Well, he doesn't say it, but we surmise that that's true.
And so his get to relive that 17 years with Yosef.
Could be the end of his life he gets to live that. That's a good point. Okay. Now he lives to be 147. Anytime you need to leave, you can go.
Okay.
It's up to you.
Thinking, yeah.
Okay. So he lives to be 147. And we pointed out that he had, that Avraham lives to be 175. And Yitzchak, his father, lives to be 180. And Yaakov lives 33 years less than his father, Yitzchak. So we pointed out before that that's the amount of words that there were in his pronouncement to Paro, that he had had a very, very rough life. And because of his pronouncement of how rough a life he had had, that shaved some years off of his life. We already pointed that out back in Parshas Vayigash. Now the Torah continues in Pasuk Chavtes, verse 29. Vayikruvu Yemei Yisrael Amus. The days of Yisrael came close to death. So it was getting towards the end of his life. Vayikra Livno LiYosef. He called to his son to Yosef. Vayomar Lo, he said to him, Imna Matzasi Chen Beinecha. If I found favor in your eyes, simna yadcha tachas yirechi, place your hand under my thigh, v'asisa imadi chesed ve'emes, and do with me kindness and truth, al nasik bereini b'mitzrayim, please do not bury me in Egypt. V'shachavti im avosai, I will lie with my fathers, which means I'll die. Unisasani mimitzrayim, you will carry me from Egypt. Ukvartani bikvurasam, and you'll bury me in their burial place, in the same burial place as my ancestors. Vayomar, and Yosef said, Anochi esechid varecha, I will do as you have said, as your words. Vayomer, and Yaakov said to him, Hishavali, swear to me. Vayishavalo, and he swore to him. Vayishtachu Yisrael al rosh hamita, and Yisrael bowed at the head of the bed. Let's pause here for a moment. So, let's first examine the fact that it says, and the days of Yisrael came close to death. What would you point out from the way that the Torah expresses that?
He's called Yisrael.
He's called Yisrael, not called Yaakov. While in the previous verse, he's called Yaakov. What have we said about the name Yisrael, as opposed to Yaakov? It's more global. It's more timeless. It's more profound. It has something to do with something beyond the moment. When you talk about Yaakov, you're talking about the man. You're talking about what's going on with his life. When you're talking about Yisrael, you're talking about more the people, the Jews, eternity, timelessness. And here it says, the days of Yisrael came close to death. This is a watershed moment for the Jewish people. Yaakov, in and of himself, of course, is an incredible man, one of the greatest people to ever live, that we're aware of. But his death is much more significant than simply a great man passing away. Yaakov's death is a pivotal moment for Yisrael, for the Jewish people. Because even though it's true that until this moment we have already seen a transition from Avos to Banim, from patriarchs and matriarchs to the children. We pointed that out back in Parshas Vayishlach, where there was clearly a change from Yaakov being the center of attention to his children being the center of attention. The spotlight of the Torah shifts from Yaakov, who happens to have a bunch of kids, to his children, who happen to have a father named Yaakov. That clearly happens, and you see that the spotlight moves in the Torah. That we saw already. But Yaakov's still alive. And as long as Yaakov's still alive, although the children are the center of attention in the spotlight, but they have that anchor. They have Yaakov. They have the patriarch. They have the one who created the Jewish people. Along with, of course, Avraham and Yitzchak. But Yaakov is the one who had the 12 tribes, and he set it all up. They've got that anchor. As long as he's on the scene, even if he's only a peripheral player, but he's there, and the fact that he's there changes everything. When he disappears from the scene, the Jewish people are never going to be the same again. Something profound has happened. Yisrael is different. We're no longer Yisrael, we're B'nai Yisrael, the children of Yisrael. The Jewish people are now the children of the one who started it all, of Yisrael. He's no longer alive. So the Torah switches from Yaakov to Yisrael to emphasize, to accentuate the fact that there is a very significant moment about to happen amongst the Jewish people, which is the fact that Yaakov is about to leave this world.
How would it be, haven't they substitute Berlin for Jerusalem?
Where does that come from?
Right.
Yeah, what is it?
They substituted Berlin for Jerusalem so that it was necessary for him to demonstrate in an impressive manner that Egypt was not their homeland. And I assume that the R monk means rabbi monk.
Okay.
How did this come together?
I don't know. I didn't read it.
No, it's right here. First paragraph on the left-hand side.
I see.
Page 269.
Hmm? 269 verse 27.
Yeah, so he's trying to make the point that he had to make, that Yaakov had to show that Egypt was not their home.
Yeah, but it wasn't.
Being that he wouldn't be buried there, to make sure that they would know that Egypt is not their home. But before we jump to that, but we're going to get to that about the fact that he wants to be buried in Israel, not in Egypt.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so I just wondered why they picked that.
Yeah, that,
from all other cities.
Because that was a refrain. Mm-hmm. That was a refrain in the 19th century. That was a refrain amongst Jewish people.
But what was the refrain?
That Berlin is the New Jerusalem.
Mm.
Yeah.
Why not say New York? Or,
you know, this is now. The Jewish people were in Berlin. They weren't anywhere.
No, they emigrated to New York.
That was later.
Baltimore.
I know what has happened in Berlin. That's why it's hitting me.
Now, his days come close to death. How did Yaakov know that his days were coming close to death?
I don't know. How
he was sick.
Know. He was sick.
Okay, he got sick.
Did people get sick then?
Okay. So here's the thing. We're gonna see in the next paragraph, which we haven't read yet, that it's gonna say that Yaakov got sick.
He did.
Yeah. Here he's not yet sick. He's becoming frail, and he realizes that he's going to die soon. The Torah, Medrash tells us that before the time of Yaakov, people did not get sick before they died. People lived till whatever age they were supposed to live, and then they would die suddenly. Yaakov prayed that he be given notice before he dies. See, sickness is a terrible thing. We do not want to be sick, we don't want anybody to be sick, and we pray that sick people get better. And that is the way it should be. We should pray that sick people get better. There is, though, what to be said for sickness prior to death. Not a sickness that the person is in terrible pain. We don't want anybody to suffer like that. But the knowledge that a person's end is near. There is what to be said for that. When a person dies suddenly, and it happens that people die suddenly, and even if the person is old and dies suddenly, the person does not have the time or the knowledge that they're going to die in order to give a last directive to their children, to whoever is going to succeed them. And there is a need amongst most people for closure. It's interesting. Nobody wants to think about this, about death, about people getting old and dying. We know, we've all experienced this, unfortunately, where a relative can become ill and can linger for a long period of time, and it's very painful. It's very painful for the person who is dying, and it's very painful for the people left behind that the person is suffering. Nobody wants the person to suffer. However, when that happens, unfortunately, when the person finally does pass away, there's a certain relief for those who are left behind. Because no one wants to see the person suffer. And the way that they were lingering on was not pleasant. And we do not believe in euthanasia. And so when God has finally decided to take that person's neshama, there's almost a sense of guilt that relatives have, that they almost feel guilty that we're happy that they've gone on, because it was just terrible. And very often when they express that, the role of the rabbi who is involved is to tell them that there's no reason to feel guilty. That's a natural human feeling, and it's a correct feeling. There's nothing wrong with a sense of relief that the person's not suffering anymore. Mm-hmm. But there's a sense of closure when that happens. When a person dies suddenly, God forbid, when that happens, on the one hand, thank God, the person didn't suffer. That's a wonderful thing. But for the relatives who are left behind, it's often very painful because there's no closure. They were here, and now they're gone. And there's no sense of having said goodbye. There's no sense of having let go. And it's often much harder for those left behind to recover from a sudden death. So it's almost like you want your cake and eat it too. You want, I mean, let's face it, we're all going to die, right? After, please God, we should all be healthy for 120 years, but we're all going to die. What's the best way? Like, almost it should be in between. That we should all get to a point where we know it's about to happen. There should be some closure, and then pass away peacefully, right? But the sudden death is very difficult for those left behind. And of course, the lingering on is very difficult for everybody. Yaakov prayed to God that he not die suddenly, because there wouldn't be a chance to give over properly what the legacy is to the Jewish people. And so he prayed that there be notice for him and for his children that it was going to happen imminently. And that's what happens over here. Yaakov gets sick in two stages. This stage that we just read was a mild sickness. It wasn't sick to die, but he realized it's going to happen soon. And that's why he calls Yosef and sets up his instructions for his burial. The next paragraph, which we haven't read yet, he's actually going to get seriously ill, at which point he will call together all of his sons and give them over a clear directive, which of course, as we all know, is our directive, because we're his children as well. And we're going to read it in Parshas Vayechi, not this evening, we will get to it in a few weeks, where we're going to be told exactly what our mission is by Yaakov. Yaakov will talk to his sons, and through his sons, he is talking to all of us in this room. What is our mission? And that's because Yaakov got sick and knew he was going to die.
Why did he have to get close to death to do that? I mean, why couldn't he have done that before? You know.
Okay, that's a good question. That's a good question. We're going to find... there's two answers to that question. One is that it's hard to talk about death before it's imminent. Why would Yaakov be setting up with his burial plan if he's got another 40 years to live? It's disconcerting to people to do that. We're also going to see that when he gives his final directive to his sons, not everything he says is going to be rosy. Some of what he says is going to be admonishment. It's going to be, you know, you have to do a little bit better. You don't say that to a person until right before. The time to say that is when a person's on their way out. Then it's accepted, then people understand that it's sincere, etc. But we'll talk about that when we get to the blessings.
Didn't he actually do that? He saved his admonishment for Reuven?
Yes, he saved it till the end.
Is there also a sense that if a person has noticed he's going to die or he's sick, he can make peace with his maker a little more easily than...
It's better all around to be aware of when it's going to happen. It's not good to know too much in advance. As if we all knew at age 18 that we were going to live until age 75, if that's what we knew, or age 90, whatever age you put on it, it would be a different life. People, even inmates on death row, even if they have 15 years to live, their lives are... It's a very depressing way to live, knowing that it's going to end at that time. We like to believe that we're immortal. We don't think about death. It's only beneficial to find out a short time beforehand. Then it's beneficial. Yeah.
One thing I just wanted to share, that my brother died of cancer, and what struck me about his the end of his life was the humility that in which he communicated with God. The humility was so impressive. The smallness of the smallness of him, which he presented to God. I'm small in front of you.
So he knew it was his time, and he was coming to grips with it.
And he also said something similar, you know, to what we're talking about. He said, Nance, I'm not afraid of dying. I'm so happy that I'm able to say goodbye to everyone.
That's beautiful.
And I'm able to, you know, share that.
That's beautiful.
Now, one thing that strikes me about this passage is that Yaakov asked Joseph to swear.
Okay.
The swearing part.
Why should he make him swear? That we're going to get to that.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's take this. I'm going in order here of the verses, but we're going to get to that. Okay. So he calls to his son Yosef, and he knows that his time is coming. He doesn't know exactly when, but he knows it's going to be soon. So he needs to arrange for his burial. Now, he called to his son to Yosef. Interestingly, Yosef was not living in the same place as Yaakov. Yaakov was living in Goshen. Yosef was not living in Goshen. We're going to find that Yosef lived actually quite a distance from Yaakov, which is surprising given that they missed each other for so long a period of time. You would think that Yosef would want to spend as much time as possible with Yaakov. We find here an amazing, amazing kindness that Yosef does. This is almost superhuman. Yaakov knows that Yosef ended up in Egypt somehow. Yaakov has never fully been apprised of the details of how Yosef ended up in Egypt. Yosef has never shared them with Yaakov. And in the spirit of being careful with Lashon Hara, Yosef does not want to share the details. Because ultimately, what difference does it make? It's over. It happened already. We missed 22 years. We can't get it back. What good is it? What's the purpose in spilling the whole thing to Yaakov and telling him all the details about how terrible his brothers were to him? Yaakov is aware to a certain extent, and we're going to find that later on, that when Yaakov does assemble his sons, he will chastise Shimon and Levi for being the main ones to sell Yosef. He will give them admonishment. But he's going to do it in a positive way. Yosef does not want to be in a position where he and Yaakov are sitting around schmoozing, where Yaakov and Yosef could very easily, what would you talk about? Like, what were those 22 years like? It must have been terrible. And then this, you start moving back to, yeah, and how you ended up there. Like, what happened? There's curiosity. Yosef does not want to slander his brothers. It's not slander, it's the truth. But he doesn't want to speak Lashon Hara. He does not want to do that to his brothers. This is in stark contrast, if you'll recall, to, again, back on page 198, in the beginning of the problem between Yosef and his brothers, what happened over there?
He would tell
his father all about what the brothers were doing. Back on page 198, we're going to pick up where we stopped reading before. He was shepherding his brothers and the sheep. I'm on the third line. And he was a young lad with the children of Bilhah and the children of Zilpah, the wives of his father. And Yosef brought the evil reports about them to their father. Here Yosef is not yet at the point where he will avoid telling his father about what his brothers had done. Now, of course, as we mentioned at the time, Yosef at 17 years old was far greater a person than any of us are today. And of course, he was much more careful with evil speech than most of us are. I can't speak for everybody in the room, but for me, for sure, I can speak that he was far better in controlling his evil speech than I am. But, nevertheless, he hadn't yet reached the level of the great Yosef, Yosef HaTzadik, Yosef the Righteous. That was going to come later. So when he's 17, he does report. When he is 100 and... How old is he now? Excuse me. He's not 100. He is 39. 39. That's when Yaakov comes to Egypt. When Yosef is 39, Yaakov is 130. So 117 years later, he is 56. At age 56, he now does not report to his father. He controls what he says. And therefore, he doesn't want to create a situation where he and Yaakov are sitting around just schmoozing. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't interact, but it does mean that he deliberately avoided having those nice, long conversations that could lead to drudging up the past.
Even though his father probably already knew.
His father knew much of it, but he did not know all the details. No. And Yaakov didn't have to know. He didn't ask. Right. Why should he have to know?
That shows incredible growth and self-control.
Incredible. Incredible.
You know, it's kind of the first thing you might tell.
Of course. You might tell the whole story. Right? Now, Yaakov says to Yosef, if I have found favor in your eyes, place your hand under my thigh, and do with me chesed ve'emes, kindness and truth, don't bury me in Egypt. Let's first focus on these words, chesed ve'emes, kindness and truth. So Rashi says it over here, and this is often quoted, especially by members of the Chevra Kadisha, those who care for the deceased, that any kindness one does with someone who has passed away is called chesed shel emes. Kindness of truth. Why is it called kindness of truth? Because kindness done with someone who has passed away is never reciprocal. If I do a favor for you, then I may be doing it out of the goodness of my heart, but I'm a human being, and it's impossible for me not to realize that you may reciprocate. That if I need help, and you're able to help me, that you'll do it. Even if you never do. But the fact is that it's a little sweeter to do a kindness with someone with whom you know may be able to reciprocate later on, even if it never happens. But you're aware of it. You know that it's a two-way street. Even the smile on your face, the thank you, the gratitude, makes me feel good. So I did kindness, and I get something back. When you do kindness for someone who has passed away, there's never any reciprocation. There's no thank you, there's no smile, and the person will never repay the kindness. That is a kindness of emes. That is a true kindness. It's a chesed that can never be reciprocated. It is a chesed that is only for the sake of chesed. And that's why those who serve on the Chevra Kadisha, those who serve on the Chevra Kadisha that attends to the needs of the dead, of the deceased, they are called those who perform chesed shel emes. The kindness that is MS, that is truth. I do want to digress just for a moment. I've done this before, but I do want to just plug again that any of you who, if you have not done this ever in the past, if you feel that you are able, serving on the Chevra Kadisha is a wonderful, wonderful opportunity for chesed, and it is something that is a profound, profound act. If you've never done it, to get involved and to take care of the deceased, it is something that will always stay with you. It's something which people naturally have an aversion to. Nobody wants to come in contact with someone who has passed away. That's for a lot of people, it's a little frightening. But after doing it, it is something which you will feel like you have done something truly, truly profound. It's a very, very special thing to do. And I won't get into details right now. Perhaps after we finish to the end, I'll give you a couple of details of that, of what it would entail and why I would encourage it. Yeah.
There is the sense when a person is doing such chesed that God is aware and he's getting credit in heaven.
There's always that. You can't get away from that. Right.
The thigh. Is that the same thigh the angel touched?
That's a good question. The answer is no. This is
question.
What's that? When it says that he put your hand under my thigh, is that referring to the thigh that the angel touched and knocked out of place, which that's really the hip.
Yeah.
This word thigh is a clean way of saying the place of the circumcision. Now, why would he say put your hand there? Because back in Parshas Chayei Sarah, which we'll...
Yeah,
Okay.
Made.
Back in Parshas Chaye Sarah. That's right. When Avraham, it's on page 110. When Avraham makes his slave Eliezer swear that he will not take a wife for Yitzchak from the daughters of Canaan, he says to him, at the top line of page 110, Simna yadcha tachas yirechi, put your hand under my thigh. Now over there, why does he make Eliezer hold the area of the circumcision? That is because it was a mitzvah. Remember that, we talked about this back then, this must have been a couple years ago already. I'm sure you all remember, like it was yesterday. But when one takes an oath, the way that the Torah has an oath, you know, and today in secular courts, they say to raise your right hand, and they hold a Bible, and you know, a person makes a takes an oath. So I don't know if they hold the Bible today. But that whole thing is borrowed from the oaths that the Torah says. In the Torah, the way that one takes an oath is one holds a significant item of a mitzvah. The best thing to hold, in other words, I don't mean the best thing, but that which makes the oath the most binding is if someone holds a sefer Torah and takes an oath. Even though the Torah has nothing to do with the oath, the oath is what I say with my mouth. The Torah, I'm not reading from the Torah, but when one holds a holy object and takes an oath, that oath is considered to be much more powerful and therefore a greater consequence if one, God forbid, violates the oath. Violating an oath is a terrible thing. We don't do that. That's one of the Ten Commandments, is not to swear falsely. Is not, well, not to take God's name in vain, which would be in swearing falsely. And the holding the Sefer Torah makes the oath much more powerful. When there's no Sefer Torah available, then an oath can be made powerful by holding a mitzvah. Well, a chumash is, one can hold that in place of the Sefer Torah. One can hold a pair of tefillin. One can hold something else like that. What objects of mitzvah did they have in their day? This is before the Torah was given. How many commandments did they have? Now, it's true that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov observed the Torah before it was given, but it wasn't given yet. Which mitzvahs were actually given? One of the very few mitzvahs that was actually given was that of circumcision. And so he told Eliezer to hold the area of circumcision because that was like holding an object of a mitzvah. And that's where he took the oath. Obviously today that would be unheard of. It would be impossible to do such a thing. It would be disgusting. But in their day, with their pure minds, that was holding an object of a mitzvah. Here Yaakov is telling Yosef the same thing. That it is an object of mitzvah to hold, to take the oath that he makes him take.
I'm struck by the fact that Yaakov is asking Yosef if he had found favor in his eyes.
Why should he say that?
Son, you know, am I okay?
Okay. Okay, good. That's a very, very good point. That's a very good point. So let's combine that with why did he make Yosef take an oath? He's his son. Isn't his guarantee good enough? What does he have to make him swear for? What's this oath?
It's because he was the viceroy, and it's possible that he wouldn't be allowed to.
Okay.
Okay.
So Yaakov tells him to do it, and Yosef says, "I'll do it." And we haven't discussed why Yaakov doesn't want to be buried in Egypt, which we'll get to in a moment. But he tells him to do it, and Yosef says, "I'll do it." Then Yaakov says, "Swear." And Yosef swears. So why the oath? So that is correct, that Yosef is the viceroy. Now the viceroy, you would think, he's got a lot of power. And he should be able to do what he pleases. The reason why Yaakov called Yosef and did not call his other sons, why didn't he call his other sons? Why didn't he call Yehuda or Levi to do this job? Why Yosef? Because Yosef's the viceroy, which means Yosef has the most power and is likely able to pull this off to take Yaakov out of Egypt and bury him in the land of Canaan. But nevertheless, you never know what impediments there may be. And there may be tremendous pressure placed on Yosef to leave Yaakov in Egypt. What would be the pressure? So this goes into why Yaakov did not want to be buried in Egypt. Rashi tells us three reasons. One is because the ground of Egypt was going to eventually become full of lice. As we know, the third of the Ten Commandments was kinim, was lice. And it wasn't just a few...
Plagues.
Where is it? Commandments. Yeah. 10 plagues, thank you. Thank you, that was a little bit of a slip there. The 10 plagues was lice. And the not just one or two lice, but rather the Torah tells us you couldn't see the ground. There was so much lice, it was fairly disgusting.
All the graves got...
So everything got covered in lice and everything got... So Yaakov did not want to be buried in the ground when the ground becomes infested with lice. Well, you may ask, but one second. I mean, his body is going to decompose anyway. So what difference does it make if there's lice? The answer is that Yaakov's body won't decompose. Because decomposition of bodies, which happens to most people, is because of sin. That after death, because unfortunately we all have sinned, therefore bodies decompose. Why does a body have to decompose? Because the process of death, we've talked about this before, is the separation of the soul from the body. The soul and the body are together in life. They are separated in death. And then, with the resurrection of the dead, the body and soul are reunited in the future. That's Techiyas HaMeisim, the resurrection of the dead. Death is a temporary state of separation between body and soul. Why is that necessary? Because before Adam and Chava ate from the tree, there was no need for death. The body and soul could have walked seamlessly into the next world. Why? Because the goal is that the body and soul are united, but there is a struggle between body and soul. The soul wants to serve God, the body wants to serve itself. And there's a struggle. Which one is going to reign supreme? Before the sin of eating from the tree, the soul had much more control over the body, and when the person, Adam, kept the mitzvah of not eating from the tree, then the soul would have completely taken over the body, and there would have been a seamless move into the next world. But because of sin, now it's much more difficult for the body to be permeated by the soul. And so it is first necessary to separate them. The body decomposes and then is reconstituted and put back together with the soul. That's what will happen. Those who are so righteous that they have either barely sinned or not sinned at all, then there's no need for that decomposition. And so the righteous ones, their bodies do not decompose. We believe there are stories of great ones who have been exhumed and their bodies have been fully intact after many, many years of burial. Yaakov, his body was going to remain intact. And so it would have been a difficulty, a problem, for the infested ground with lice to be with Yaakov's body. That was one reason. Reason number two is that Yaakov understood that the Egyptians might very well turn him into a deity. That's right, an Avodah Zarah. After all, he came and ended the famine. He came and walked over to the banks of the Nile, and the Nile overflowed. He was the cause for such prosperity in Egypt. It was very likely that they would then worship Yaakov, and he didn't want anything to do with that. And so he said, get me out of here, don't bury me here. And finally, the third reason Rashi tells us, which is something which is relevant today, is that we know that in the time of Tchiyas HaMeisim, of the resurrection of the dead, the bodies will go from wherever they're buried to Israel. The resurrection will happen in Israel. They will go under tunnels under the ground to Israel. That migration from wherever a person is buried to Israel is supposed to be something which is unpleasant. It is not a pleasant experience to go under the ground to Israel. I don't know what it means. I haven't done it, so I can't tell you. But whatever it is, no. That doesn't happen yet. And so, whatever it is, I don't know. but it's not supposed to be a pleasant experience. And so that is why many people try to get themselves buried in Israel, because when one is buried in Israel, then one doesn't have to endure that problem. What we know today is, and what we do today in order to avoid that, because we do bury people outside of Israel, is that by putting some dirt from the land of Israel into the grave, that apparently takes away from the problem. And that's why if you have ever served on a Chevra Kadisha, you'll find, or whenever you do, you'll find that after they finish the process of cleaning the body and dressing the body in preparation for death, for burial, excuse me, and place them into the coffin, then they will take a bag with dirt from Israel, and they will pour that dirt into the coffin. There's different customs where to put the dirt exactly, but they'll put the dirt on the body, and that is supposed to take away from this problem of needing to migrate, the pain or the difficulty of migrating to Israel. Yaakov, they had no dirt from Israel there, and he wanted to be buried in Israel. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking that maybe one of the reasons he wanted to be buried in Israel was not because when all the bodies that are buried will have this problem going to Israel underground, but that future generations would not stay in Egypt, but they would, live bodies would move to Israel.
Okay, so this is really what you read in the commentary before, which is that Yaakov was trying to make a statement that Egypt is not our home. We don't stay here. This is not our home. And even though there would have been a benefit for the children who are going to be in Egypt for another 193 years, 210 minus 17, almost 200 years they're going to be in Egypt, it would have been very comforting to have Yaakov buried there, to go pray at the grave of Yaakov. It would have been comforting, but it was more important for Yaakov to make the statement that this is not our home, and therefore he wanted to be buried in Egypt.
Wasn't there already a place for him?
Yes.
And Leah was there.
Yeah.
He was supposed to be there.
Yeah, but he could have been buried in Egypt and then exhumed when they went up to Israel. That could have happened. But in the end, he said, no, don't do that. I don't want to be buried here ever. Just move me into Israel.
Is there also a teaching lesson for Yosef?
That what?
Makes Yosef promise and makes a big impression on
okay.
Yosef in order for Yosef to also ask
yeah.
the same thing.
Yeah, he's going to ask for it as well. But when Yosef asks for it at the very end of Vayechi, Yosef is not going to be asked to be buried in Israel. He's going to say, when you leave Egypt, take me with you. Because he knows they're not going to be able to take him up to bury him there. Because they don't have the power.
So he had to suffer the lice problem.
That's right. Well, he's in the bottom of the Nile. It's more, the blood problem is more problem for him.
Yeah. Right.
But we'll talk about him when we get there. But for Yaakov, as you can see, there would have been a lot of pressure on Yosef that he must bury Yaakov in Egypt. Now, this oath ends up being very powerful, and it stops the pressure that would have been put on Yosef. Why? Because you'll recall that Yosef became very very knowledgeable very quickly when he went before Paro. Paro had I don't know if it was in his throne room or wherever it was, there was a series of 70 steps that in front of Paro. And Paro knew all 70 languages of the world. And Paro had a rule that you were only able to ascend as many steps as languages that you were conversant in. So if you spoke 3 languages, you went up 3 steps. If you spoke 12 languages, 12 steps. Mm-hmm. Paro knew 70, and no one else did. Yosef, before he came before Paro, the Medrash tells us that the angel Gavriel came to him and taught him all 70 languages. But more than that, Yosef knew a language that Paro didn't know, because Yosef knew Lashon HaKodesh, the holy tongue, which is the tongue of the Torah, which is the 71st language. It is the language that preempts all the other ones. So Yosef came into Paro and started going up the steps. And Paro is looking at him. He's never seen anybody go up so many steps. And Yosef goes right up to Paro and says, I get another step. So Paro was naturally awestruck by this. But in addition, Paro was concerned that no one should find out that Yosef actually knows a language that he doesn't know. And so he made Yosef swear not to divulge that he knew a language that Paro did not know. Later on, as we will find, Paro will tell Yosef, go bury your father, Yaakov, after he dies. Go bury him in Israel, as he made you swear. And the commentaries say, what do you mean, as he made you swear? That had he not made you swear, I would have made you bury him here in Egypt. But what happened is, Paro said to Yosef, bury him here. Yosef says, I can't. I swore that I would take him to Israel. So Paro says, I don't care. I want you to violate your oath. Yosef says, okay, if you want me to violate that oath, I'll also violate the oath that I took not to divulge the language that you don't know. So Paro says, oh, one second. Hold on a second. No. I take it back. Take him up to Israel and bury him there. So the fact that he took an oath kept Paro from being able to pressure Yosef. The oath meant that Yosef had leverage because there was another oath that Paro did not want divulged. So we'll talk about that more when we get to the conversation between Yaakov and Yosef before the burial between Yosef and Paro before the burial of Yaakov. Yeah?
Dies suddenly, and there's no closure to the family. How does one attain closure?
You mean how those who are left behind attain closure?
Yeah.
It's more difficult. There is always a way of doing it, and it has to do with thinking through about what the person meant, and the fact is that a sudden death is much more pleasant for the person who died, so that there's always comfort in that at least the person didn't suffer. And I think the closure is attained by thinking through what they meant, what the legacy was, or is.
It takes time.
July
4th, my 61-year-old nephew said, I don't feel well, on an airplane, and that was it.
Wow.
I had to spell his name out of my phone book. Mm. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I talked to his wife a lot.
Yeah, that's very hard.
But it's a time.
It's very, very, it's very difficult. Yeah.
I may be jumping ahead, but
yeah.
If Joseph takes Yaakov back to Israel, do his brothers go with him?
Yes.
So why do they come back to Egypt?
Because they don't take everything, as we'll see.
Okay.
There is some collateral behind. As we'll see.
And also, so why is Yaakov asking Joseph if he found favor?
Okay, so here, Yaakov is now asking Yosef for something. Remember, this is the reciprocation. That until now, the first 17 years, it was Yaakov taking care of Yosef. The past 17 years, it's been Yosef taking care of Yaakov. Mm-hmm. Now Yaakov needs to ask him for the ultimate favor. Until now, it's been child play. Because until now, it's just been giving food, a place to live, minor things. But now Yaakov knows that this is a major card. This is not a simple matter. This is something which is going to cost Yosef a great deal politically. This is going to be a lot of political capital that Yosef is going to have to use to get Yaakov out of Egypt. And so that's why he says to him, if I found favor in your eyes, in other words, I'm asking you for a big deal. I understand. I'm not asking you for a small change here. I'm asking you for a major favor. And that's what he does. One last point for this evening. And that is that Yisrael bows on the head of the bed. So what does it mean on the head of the bed? So there are a couple of meanings over here. First of all, who is he bowing to? He's bowing to Yosef. He's bowing to Yosef. Why does he bow to Yosef? So our sages say an important phrase here. I'll tell you the words in Aramaic, but you don't need to copy this down. Tala b'idna b'idnei sagidlei, which means a wolf in his time bow to him. So what does that mean? Usually we say that the king of the beasts is the lion. And any time you have an animal that is analogous to royalty, it's the lion. Yehuda is compared to a lion. A fox. A fox is not considered to be the king of the beasts. However, a fox is considered to be a very wily creature. And the Chazal are saying is, our sages are saying, even a fox, if it's his time, which means he's in a position of authority, bow to him. Don't stand on principle and say, I'm not bowing to him, he's only a fox. Yeah, he's only a fox. But if he's right now in control, then if he's in a position of power, then acknowledge it. Don't pretend that he's not. So even though, of course, Yaakov and Yosef, who's the authority? Of course, Yaakov's the authority. He's the father. Yosef's the son. But at the same time, Yosef's the viceroy. He's in a position of power. Don't ignore that. Don't take it for granted. Don't pretend it doesn't exist. Even a fox, if it's his time, bow to him. That's the lesson we learn from here. But the phrase still says the head of the bed. Rosh Hamita, the head of the bed. So here, our sages tell us...
Is that what the angel of death is?
No, that'll be later. We'll get to that. We'll get to that later. But our sages say... I just want to read the phrase over here. One moment, please. Yeah. Our sages say two other things here. That Yaakov turned to the head of the bed and he bowed. And from here we learn that the Shekhinah, God's divine presence, is at the head of the bed of someone who is sick. Someone who is sick, meaning deathly ill, someone who is sick, the Shekhinah, God's divine presence, is at the head of his bed. It's not coincidental that when a person is near death, they begin to recognize God more profoundly, which was mentioned before. Obviously, the fact that they're about to die is very important, and that obviously is a very sobering thing, makes a person think about God, but it's more than that. God's presence is there. When a person is sick, God's presence is at the head of his bed. That is the case. So Yaakov, knowing this, bowed, although he was bowing to Yosef, but turned towards the head of the bed to acknowledge that God's presence was there. He's with him in his pain, in his sickness. And finally, the fact is that Yaakov is called Mitaso Shlema. His bed was complete. Because Yaakov had 12 tribes, all of them turned out righteous. Although there were some bumps along the road, as we know, and we're going to talk about them later on, but in the end, all 12 turned out righteous, all 12 turned out good. Yaakov had a complete bed, which means his offspring were complete, were the way they should be. And he bowed in acknowledgement that, thank God, he was able to produce and raise the 12 tribes of Israel. And that's the bowing over here. We'll continue, please God, next week, and then we will learn about when he gets to when his sickness becomes acute, and he knows it's a matter of very, very short time, where he will then bless first Yosef's children and then all of his children. And that'll be going next week. Next week, please God, we will meet at regular time at 7:30.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the Donate link. Thank you very much.